Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred and I were just talking about whether you can make reliability or focus on checking reliability, and what that means to actually baking reliability into your product, system, or service.
Well, that's only because you just wrote a pretty interesting article that got posted. We've got to remember to link back to it. But it sounds sure. Like you had an interesting experience with somebody trying to come up with a guideline or a body of knowledge or something about how to do reliability. And I thought that you had an interesting take on it, and I'm sure you impressed the daylights out of them and told them, I'll go back to work and try again.
No, I didn't. It was a couple of years ago, and I don't typically like picking on certain bodies of people or documents where, you know, where there's a chance that it can be attributable. But I think this one, I had to make an exception, and it was, and in the article, I was talking about a time. It's a conference, 3 years ago now. How the time has flown. Where the U.S. Department of Defense and industry representatives were trying to come up with a document to replace all the mill standards and mill handbooks and mill guidebooks, which have been forcibly taken out of service, I should say, but have been still being used to this day. And one of the documents that was being talked about was this reliability body of knowledge, the reliability maintainability engineering body of knowledge. And I went, that sounds interesting, let's have a look at it. And I looked at a quick reference guide, and the problem for me, Fred, was that quick reference guide was almost like a how to create a generic project schedule to include specific mandated reliability engineering activities, not much more. Mm-hmm. And my article sort of followed that thought process.
Well, the interesting part that caught my eye was that you broke down how many of these recommend. I mean, there's a whole issue separate of creating a generic project schedule and everything else without really considering what is it you're trying to do. Because I've seen way too many people say, thou shalt do FMEA at this point, and this point, and they do it, but nobody ever uses it. So they don't really think through what needs to be done when to add value. And that's a whole separate conversation. The one I caught and wanted to talk to you about was that a significant portion of the activities were reactive, or just let's just go measure it or test it or evaluate it. And you pulled out a bunch of verbs instead of like, let's go, instead of doing stress strength analysis and derating and simulations and looking for our failure mechanisms, was let's go see if it has a few, it doesn't have too many failure mechanisms, and then we'll call it good instead. I'm like, well, that's kind of not reliability engineering in my mind. It's a part of it, but it shouldn't be that proportion of it.
No, and there will always be failure mechanisms. You're not going to ever remove failure mechanisms. You can, I mean, if you're concerned about fatigue, for example, you're never going to remove fatigue as a failure mechanism. But what you can do is use a material or surface treatment such that the failure mechanism, which will never go away, will simply not manifest itself during the 20-year life of type or whatever it is that matters the most. I mean, right. Failure mechanisms are physical phenomena that you can't eradicate. Only God can do that, presumably. Yep. So we have to live with them. We can just control them.
Well, the other way that you see people eliminating them is they, and I use the car tire as an example, is you run the car. If we know the tread wear exists, but if we assume that the amount of probability of failure is constant for the life of that tire, we can test 1,000 tires for 100 miles, and we get this great figure of merit that they survived and they didn't go flat or do anything wrong, and just ignore that they wear out. And then we design a test or a way to show, demonstrate that it's good.
I'm sorry, Fred, but aren't you just talking about the entire electronic component industry?
Pretty much, yeah.
Because what you described is exactly what they do.
Oh, yeah. That's what we see. Vast majority do. And some of them, or vast majority of them, are saying that that's based on mill standards. But part of the process is, I mean, and I also have, I mean, reliability growth, it's a fine tool. It has some quirks and some interesting issues with it and so on. But the idea is that you build, test, fix, and you continue to improve your design until you achieve some level of reliability that's acceptable or what's capable of that. The issue I have is that somebody says, thou shalt do reliability growth. They plan for it, and then they use the planned outcome as the final number and never actually do any improvements in the design. And I'm like, come on, guys, that's not what this is for. But the idea of setting up a body of knowledge, the issue I have with what you illustrated in the article is the body of knowledge pretty much sets the stage for the mindset of how to view reliability engineering work. And the primary issue is that it's just a series of hurdles to overcome and to just measure it without any real teeth into making any changes or adding anything else than that you tick off the boxes that we did all these tests is in checks or reviews or whatever. And I, that's not the idea. And you and I and the other hosts of this show have talked about at great length, it's influencing the point of decision throughout the design process. And it's not throw it over the wall to reliability guys to help let them prove that you did a good job. No, it works the other way, guys.
Right. So, and just to maybe illuminate the listeners who haven't read the article or are unaware of what we're talking about. So military acquisition, at least in North America, tends to have a number of phases, five phases, at least that's what it was back in 2019. The first phase is where they're coming up with a material solution analysis, which is essentially working out, well, how are we going to solve this military need? And the last phase is operations and the support phase. Mm-hmm. And what Fred's talking about, or what you're talking about, Fred, in regard to me adding up all the different activities, I looked at what turned out to be 58 separate activities that were outlined in this quick reference guide, and they were simply points that occurred on a schedule. And so, for example, you would have in the material solution analysis phase, the schedule would have 12 activities which you need to complete as you go through, for example, creating a test and evaluation master plan, things like that, system engineering plan, and you tick off all these activities as you move through these phases. And there are 58 in total. And when I looked at each activity, I looked for the key word in how that activity was described. So out of those 58, 23, so essentially half, were review activities. 14 were analyze or evaluate activities. 13 were prepare or update document activities, which is
change the plan to fit the new desired outcome.
That might be simplifying a little bit, but realistically, updating a document shouldn't be heralded as the amazing
outcome that it uses anything.
Yeah, that's right. It shouldn't be its own step on a schedule, you would argue. And then we started getting a lot fewer numbers. So what's 23, 14, 13, add that together, that's 50. And we have 8 activities left. And four of those were verify, validate, or test activities. 2 were planning activities, and I use that term fairly generously in terms of what I read. Another one was a status reporting activity, and the final one was a trade-off activity. So you can see just the overwhelming majority of these activities were reviewing, analyzing, evaluating, preparing or updating documents, verifying, validating, testing. No stage in any of these activity descriptions do we see anything that relates to making better decisions when it comes to designing for reliability or how military customers are supposed to motivate or guide or otherwise make reliability happen when it comes to that design process.
Yeah, the only one that even is close without seeing the details of it would be the trade-off one. And that's probably not what they're talking about. There's like, so how many of these things can we waive versus and get away with it? It's probably the trade-off they're doing.
Yeah, you're not far off. I'm going to go through my notes and see if I can get the exact wording. But while I'm doing that, I'll keep scouting. But yeah, the planning activities, for example, they were pretty, they weren't real planning. It was just all about scheduling time and money for tests, mm-hmm. for example, as opposed to coming up with, are we going to focus on modular design or modular maintainability? Are we going to are we going to have a really strong predictive maintenance philosophy? What's the approach to making something reliable versus making a project plan which looks like it's reliable?
Well, I think one of the phrases that jumped out at me is that, and it resonates with me, is this: doing a bunch of activities is not doing reliability work or engineering work. You know, you can tick off dozens and dozens, well, 58 different activities and still have a crap product at the end of the day. I think they completely missed the point. Is right. Kind of the thought I had, which is not atypical of, there's one mil-spec that kind of people would pull the cover off and put a new label on top of it saying, here's our reliability plan. And the first paragraph says must be tailored to each individual circumstance, but somehow that preamble piece of any of these mil-specs get overlooked real quick. And, oh, we have to do these 58 different activities and then we'll be reliable. Well, it's not how it works.
No, it's and the trade activity, I found it here, and the words are exactly perform design, concept, architectural, and requirements trades prescribed by the RAMC report guidance to optimize the conceptual design with respect to reliability, maintainability, performance, availability, logistics factors, and life cycle costs. Now, that all sounds well and good. This is happening very early on. It's not happening after any real design effort has been invested. So we see, okay, so that's what our tank's going to look like. Didn't know that, didn't realize that, didn't think that would be that heavy or that would have that thermal profile. So this is very big hand, small map at the very start.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that is a huge undertaking to genuinely trade off things like logistics factors, which is a broad statement to say the least, with fundamental ideas about how we're going to design our system. We absolutely need to think about it. A very good example would be, are we going to have a strategy of modular maintenance in a military setting versus a repair forward maintenance? So that means if something breaks, do we just take that module out of our tank, ship that module back, that module then gets repaired and shipped back forward to sit on the shelf the next time the module fails, and the maintainer simply puts that module that has already been, that the other module that's been sitting on the shelf, straight back in to keep our tank working, versus take the module out, take it to a workshop, repair it in the workshop, module goes back in. There's very different maintenance strategies, and they each have their own strengths and weaknesses. And that has to be designed into a system. So I absolutely endorse thinking about that moving forward. Do we have a modular maintenance strategy or do we have a repair forward maintenance strategy? The problem I see in real life, though, is that different manufacturers will give the customer a design based on a modular or not non-modular maintenance, mainly because the customer hasn't really been verbose when asking for it.
I don't know. I mean, some of the idea of thinking through this stuff early, the way you read the trade-off part was the one I thought, that is closer to, and it is a lot of big words, and I'm sure there's more detail to it. And you're right, it does take a lot of work, and it's an evolving, ongoing process. It's not an activity that's done once.
No.
And that's where I've seen previous mill handbooks and other contracting language and stuff like that is like, It avoids the stuff that's hard to measure, which is unfortunate because that culture around an organization about how they use this information and how they tie it together and how they make decisions and the flexibility needed to actually implement that well gets stripped out when it's, well, on Tuesday, we have to do an FMEA. Independent of what else, why or whatever else we need to do, or whether FMEA is needed or not. The contract says do it on Tuesday, so we're going to do it on Tuesday.
What a good FMEA looks like.
Right, and it doesn't matter whether it's good or not. It's just that we've done it, and we don't have time on Tuesday to do that, so we'll outsource it. But it still meets the terms of the contract, so they're good, and they get paid for it. And that's just wrong in my mind. Mm-hmm. And the body of knowledge, the way you're describing it and the outline you gave, just reinforces that they're going to measure. They're going to write it so that they can do things they can measure. Well, we got the report on Tuesday, so you can check that off the list. But I've rarely run into somebody in the military settings that stops and says, well, how are you using this information? Mm-hmm. You know, where do these results actually get used? And if you want to see deer in the headlight, drive at dusk around here, or ask somebody that question.
I think you and I have both served in the military, so we know how suffocating the bureaucracy and I suppose the sedentary inertia in terms of, oh, it's always been done this way and that's mm-hmm. How it works. We're aware of that. And it can be suffocating. And at least my experience is that it took me getting out of said military environment to realize that while there's so many really good things about how that environment works and can bring a lot of good things to the table in practice, there's so many other approaches which involve, dare I say, a lot more trust and a lot more genuine first principles approaches. And I think there's this culture of helplessness in some of bigger organizations where we feel like we're asking this company over here to design this wonderful new product for us. It looks amazing, but they're the experts. They're the ones who are going to go and design. They're the ones who are going to identify, meet, and hopefully conquer every single design challenge as we go through it. Who are we to be able to get in that space and be genuine collaborators or partners in terms of trying to find a great solution for us? Mm-hmm. And so we then go back into our process shells where we say, well, let's review. Let's mandate standards. Let's evaluate. Let's do 2 years of testing because of this culture of helplessness when it comes to genuine influence genuinely influencing design.
Oh, yeah. So there's so many stories of how that help individuals in that whole process feel helpless. But there's on occasion, there's somebody that stands up and asks questions and you know, says, hey, the emperor has no clothes here kind of thing. The issue is there's not enough of those voices. Hopefully, and I've heard over and over again that the campaign to eradicate MTBF is slowly making its way through the corridors of all kinds of industries. So it can be done. It does take time. But despite Mil Handbook 217 being, you know, basically said, don't use it. It's not valid. If we're not using this anymore, you know, or some Department of Defense secretary said, no, we're not using any more of these things. Get rid of them. They still exist, which mm-hmm. speaks to the inertia within the system. But it's not just the military. I've worked with one of the commands that wanted to update some of their documents, and they purposely wanted the information as to, well, what does industry do? What does the medical device industry do? What does oil and gas do? What does, you know, automotive do? What does, you know, high tech do? And so that's why I got hired. And I'm sitting in and I was hired by a tier one, which is basically got paid for doing most of the design work and coordinating all of the systems, architectures, and all this other stuff. They did not want to change. So they rejected draft after draft after draft, saying, well, you're not. And I sat there with the representative from the military. This, I don't know, he's a light colonel or what rank he had. But he was, do you want me to write what you should do based on industry best practices, or do you want me to write down what you are already doing and you know it's not working? And the tier one guys there that hired me basically, to give you an idea of where their state of mind was, is said, you need to actually use distributions, not point estimates. He says, well, in our 35 plus years of designing systems, we've never run across any component, any system, any element that has ever been anything other than exponential distribution.
Good Lord.
Really? How's that true? He says, well, we just assume it, and therefore they all are. He actually said that.
There you go.
And I looked at the guy from the Army, and I says, how's your systems working? They're not. That's why we're talking. And they just still didn't get it. But they were so entrenched and so tied at the hip that they just couldn't recognize that they were going to lose their business with the military unless they woke up. And it sounds like the body of knowledge is not helping with the process of helping the military industry complex talk reasonably to each other and actually create reliable products.
Right. And I think we're often caught as individuals or organizations thinking that we don't have the power as customers, and we absolutely do.
Yep.
Sure, it can be difficult to think you can stand up, but you can often stand up and say, no, I paid for this. I'm not getting this. I'm not going to change. When I say change, I'm not going to change how much I'm going to pay you, i.e. pay you more to accommodate the fact this is not what I asked for.
Yeah.
It's this overwhelming culture of helplessness, which is now formalized with this whole focus on process and focus on procedure, because that's the only thing you can control. You can control how many reports you get, how many reports you write, and what each report is supposed to say, or the headings of each report.
Yep.
You can control that. When you talk about trying to control the design process, that's where things get scary. And you and I both know there's plenty of design teams or contractors out there who crave that sort of engagement, where they'd love to be able to sit down with you as a customer and say, well, what's as you say, Fred, what's keeping you up at night? Let's work on, tell us what it is that concerns you the most, and we'll focus our efforts on designing a system which solves that problem. It's those other organizations which are, well, we've been doing this for 35 years. That's your first problem.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, it's, so anyway, it's an interesting read. I'm sure there's more to that topic. Probably it could generate a handful of other papers and podcast episodes and so on. So if you're listening to this, and I know we have some folks in the military systems and industry and so on.
I still love you guys.
Still love you. Sure. You're all great. You know,
big fans.
And we encourage you to stand up and say, hey, there is a better way. Let's go do that instead. Just because that's the way you've always been doing it doesn't mean that's the right way to do it, or there isn't a better way to do it. It is a big system, and it takes some persistence to make changes in it, but it can be done. Let me back up. I'm not going to ask you to tell us where your challenges are and stuff like that, or if you've got a breakthrough, or if you're making progress even in your local area, we'd love to hear that. And if you've got a question or an idea for a future podcast, we'd love to hear from you over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a contact page, and it has a SpeakPipe widget. And there you can actually record a comment or a question for us that we may be able to use on a future podcast. So you could literally join the conversation, or you could type in something for us, or get a hold of us through LinkedIn or through our about pages. Lots of ways to get in touch. And we certainly do enjoy hearing from you. And success stories, welcome as always. And questions or ideas or suggestions are also always welcome. So I don't know, Chris, how long did it take before the nightmares of that meeting wear off? Did you get over it real quick and realize they're on their own? And
I mean, I do feel sorry for, we've been in that situation with our own careers, but I just feel sorry for people who, for whatever reason, are forced to operate in that construct, and there is a better way.
There is. Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, let's go off to the rest of the day doing our good stuff and see what happens, and look forward to hearing from our listeners.
Absolutely.
All right. Talk to you later, Chris.
Thanks, Fred. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.